That was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Croatian leaders have put the army on alert after crowds of migrants scuffled with police along the border with Serbia, where they seek to enter the European Union. Croatia became the latest pressure point in the migrant crisis after Hungarian riot police used force to turn back people at the country's border with Serbia. Meantime, European Parliament backed a plan to distribute some 120,000 refugees among European Union member countries. Head of Burkina Faso's new ruling council says the president and prime minister are safe in military custody and will soon be released. Emily Yobe has more on the coup.
Early Thursday, a soldier, Colonel Mamadou Bamba, announced on state television that this is indeed a coup.
Le président de la transition est démis de ses fonctions.
Bamba says the interim president is dismissed from his function. He says the transitional government and the National Transition Council are dissolved and that the consultation will take place to form a new government in charge of organizing inclusive elections. Emilia for VOA News in Abidjan.
At least three people were reported killed as young protesters attempted to gather near the presidential palace in Ouagadougou. The U.S. Embassy says roadblocks have been put up across the city. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country cannot join the U.S.-led coalition battling the Islamic State militants in Syria because it is illegal. He says the U.S. and its allies should not reject cooperation with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad because his forces are the most capable to fight terrorism. White House repeated its assertion the Assad government is responsible for the disaster in Syria and the growth of the Islamic State militants. This is VOA News. Islamic State group claimed responsibility for a series of suicide bombings in Baghdad that killed at least 21, wounded more than 50 others. The attacks struck two predominantly Shiite neighborhoods in the Iraqi capital. Civilian and police are among the victims in that blast. The Obama administration can begin implementing the International Nuclear Accord with Iran following Thursday's expiration of a 60-day legislative review period. The Republican-led Congress here in Washington failed to block the pact despite fierce majority opposition in both chambers. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell led the charge.
We cannot allow Iran to be empowered as a nuclear threshold state armed with billions in sanctions relief without at least providing some protection, to Israel first, without at least demanding the release of Americans who've languished in Iranian custody for years.
Democrats banded together to block the measure, just as they repeatedly did with a resolution disapproving the entire nuclear accord. Two international organizations have criticized Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko for signing a decree that banned 41 international journalists and bloggers from entry into Ukraine for 1 year. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and the Committee to Protect Journalists condemned the decree, which places sanctions on 388 companies and individuals deemed to represent what was referred to as an actual or potential threat to national interests, national security, sovereignty, and the territorial integrity of Ukraine. U.S. Central Bank says record low interest rates will remain unchanged for now. That story from Mill Arcega.
The much-anticipated meeting of Federal Reserve officials concluded Thursday with no change in monetary policy. The reasoning, said Fed Chair Janet Yellen, was that despite an improving outlook for the U.S. economy, there are still too many questions on how slower growth in China will affect the world's largest economy.
In light of the developments that we have seen and the impacts on financial markets, we want to take a little bit more time to evaluate the likely impacts on the United States.
On Wall Street, it was a mixed day at best, with key indexes unsure which way to go. After rising nearly 1.5% following the announcement, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed nearly 0.5% lower. Millar Sega, VOA News, Washington.
And the U.S. Weather Agency says across the globe, the heat is unrelenting, setting new temperature highs for the month that are unparalleled in 136 years of record keeping. You can get more news by going to our website at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, September 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union calls on Burkina Faso's coup leaders to hand over power.
We have issued a statement and demanded that the military hand over power to the transitional authority that was there, the president, the prime minister, and other relevant authorities.
Erastus Muecha is the deputy chairman of the African Union Commission. The death toll rises in South Sudan's oil tanker explosion. A U.S. trade mission seeks to boost investment in Africa. And a new report says the Gambia under President Yahya Jammeh is a country in a state of fear characterized by rampant repression.
We found that the government of Gambia commits very serious human rights abuses against virtually anyone who dissents. That includes journalists, opposition figures, human rights defenders, and even members of their own security forces.
Felicity Thompson is principal researcher and author of a new Human Rights Watch report on the Gambia. Somalia sends a new ambassador to the United States, the second in more than 24 years. And a Texas ninth grader of Sudanese descent is arrested after his clock invention is suspected to be an explosive. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The deputy chairman of the African Union Commission says the African Union condemns the overthrow of Burkina Faso's transitional government less than 3 weeks before the country's scheduled October 11th election. Erastus Muecha says the African Union has demanded the new military leaders in Burkina Faso immediately hand over power to the transitional government. Muecha tells reporter Peter Clotty that the African Union's Peace and Security Council will soon meet to review the current situation in Burkina Faso and decide the organization's next line of action.
We have issued a statement and demanded that the military hand over power to the transitional authority that was there, the president, the prime minister, and other relevant authorities. First of all, under the African Union, any change of government that is unconstitutional is automatically condemned because we believe in the rule of law and encourage that any change of power must follow the constitutional process. Notwithstanding that, this coup is coming only less than 3 weeks to the general elections that was going to be held on the 10th of October. We at the African Union had already provided for an observation team to go and monitor the elections. So there is no justification whatsoever for this team to have taken this, especially at this point.
Honorable Muecha, is possible targeted sanctions on the table if the Peace and Security Council of the African Union examines the current situation of this coup d'etat in Burkina Faso?
Well, I cannot provide the range of sanctions that will be provided. What you have said is an option that is could be on the table and any other sanctions. And so let the Peace and Security Council meet. Then, of course, the Peace and Security Council will decide the best form of sanctions or action that should be taken.
When will they begin meeting and for how long before coming up with a plan to address this concern?
The Peace and Security Council was having a meeting in Abuja, Nigeria. Many of those who are there are on their way back. Actually, they are now en route, they are on flight. And when they arrive here, then we'll consult and agree on the best timing for that. So consultation is underway. As soon as they land, then we can name the date when they are meeting or the time.
Is there a collaboration between the African Union, of course, ECOWAS, and the international community in terms of the UN Security Council to help address this problem in Burkina Faso?
In the statement that has been issued by the chairperson of the African Union Commission, we have also enjoined ourselves and requested that other parties we work together, including ECOWAS and the UN, so that we can face this as one.
What is the African Union's message to the people of Burkina Faso or Burkinabes concerning this coup?
First of all, right now we have information that people are protesting. We have information further that one person has already died, and we can only appeal for calm. We can appeal for people not to cooperate until such time that this military junta is really made to surrender power or any other actions that will be taken.
Erastus Muecha is the deputy chairman of the African Union Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clarty from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. A new report says the Gambia under President Yahya Jammeh is a country in a state of fear characterized by rampant repression, torture, arbitrary detentions, and enforced disappearances. The report, State of Fear, published Thursday by Human Rights Watch, accuses the government of targeting journalists, human rights defenders, student and religious leaders, political opposition, the LGBT community, or anyone who dares disagree with President Jammeh. Felicity Thompson is principal researcher and author of the report. She says while President Jammeh deserves some credit for pardoning death row inmates in July, he must do more by releasing all those who are wrongfully detained. Thompson says the government must also impartially investigate abuses by the country's security forces.
Well, the Gambia is a small country with a fairly large human rights problem. Many people know it for its beautiful beaches, but beyond the tourist spots, there's a very repressive government that for more than 20 years has created a state of fear. We found that the government of Gambia commits very serious human rights abuses against virtually anyone who dissents. That includes journalists, opposition figures, human rights defenders, and even members of their own security forces who are implicated in coups, and also, more recently, targeting the lesbian, gay, and bisexual community in Gambia.
This report covers what, October 2014 to August 2015. Who did you talk to?
We interviewed victims and witnesses of these abuses in Gambia and also outside the country. What was really striking about the research was a very palpable sense of fear. People were very afraid to speak to us. They believed they were under surveillance and that they would suffer retaliation for speaking about human rights abuses.
You say here that to prevent such abuses from recurring, the government should thoroughly and impartially investigate abuses by members of the security forces. Are you talking to the government in Gambia? Do you think they listen to you?
That's a very good question. We are calling on the Gambian government to investigate and prosecute those who are credibly implicated in serious abuses like unlawful killings, enforced disappearances, torture, arbitrary arrest. We have attempted to communicate with the government in Banjul. We shared our findings and recommendations with the government and offered an opportunity to reply and to input into our report. Unfortunately, we didn't hear back from the government, but we are looking forward to engaging with them, working with them on our recommendations.
You say that Gambia's international partners and other governments should consistently and publicly condemn abuses by the Gambian government. When you talk about international partners, who can do this without Gambia saying you're interfering in my internal affairs?
I mean, increasingly, the international community is speaking out about the horrific human rights abuses in Gambia, but they need to do more. Countries like the United States, countries like the United Kingdom, the European Union, they should insist that Gambians are protected from torture, illegal killings, and disappearances. They should pressure the Gambian government to disband paramilitary groups who are committing terrible abuses.
The Gambian government recently made some adjustments by releasing some people. That shows that perhaps are they responding to the criticism, some of which have been raised in your report?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen some positive signs more recently from the Gambian government. In July, President Jammeh pardoned and released over 200 prisoners, and that included political prisoners also. But it's not enough. We need the Gambian government to go further in this direction and release all of those who are wrongfully detained.
Felicity Thompson is the principal researcher and author of a new Human Rights Watch report on the Gambia. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 18th. Please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Over 100 people were killed and many more injured in South Sudan's western Equatoria State after a fuel tanker that had crashed exploded while people were scooping up the fuel. Fellow Tito Justin with VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports.
Maridi County Commissioner William Thomas Yanga says 176 people were killed when a fuel tanker burst into flame about 20 kilometers outside the town of Yambio. Officials say they do not know why the truck overturned. But as frequently happens with fuel spillages, people rushed to where the truck lay on its side to try to collect petrol from the leaking tanker. Among those soaking up fuel with rags or collecting it in jerrycans were soldiers, boda-boda riders, women and children. County Sub-Chief Mariam Tito says the fuel exploded in a fireball when some of the soldiers fired their weapons to try to disperse the crowd so that they could have the fuel for themselves. She says some of the soldiers had climbed on top of the overturned tanker truck and were filling their jerrycans. She says those soldiers were among the scores of people who were burned into death. She says many women and children died too. Tito says many of the victims were buried at the side of the road near where they perished. VOA does not have independent confirmation of the death toll. Tito says the number of deaths is likely to increase because many of the injured were badly burned. She says the hospital in the town of Maridi is overwhelmed with victims. Tito says the beds are full, and as more burns patients are brought into the hospital, they are being laid on the floor. Justin Badi is the bishop of the Episcopal Church in Maridi Diocese. He says the church is trying to raise funds to help the families of those who died and for the burns victims who are in the hospital.
We are coordinating also with our community and with our government so that they can come and rescue the situation.
The bishop says poverty is the cause of this tragedy. He says if fuel were affordable and people had jobs that paid them a decent living, they would not have rushed to the scene of the accident to try to gather fuel. South Sudan produces around 160,000 barrels of oil a day. The nation's economy is dependent on exports of oil, which account for nearly all of the government's revenues. But since the country erupted in violence in December 2013, the prices of fuel and many other essentials have sort of putting them out of reach to ordinary South Sudanese. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Washington.
Somalia's new ambassador to the United States, the second in more than 24 years, Thursday presented his credentials to President Barack Obama. The 60-year-old Ahmed Issa Award is a former United Nations peacekeeping official in Sudan. Ambassador Award's arrival in Washington comes 2 days after the United States reopened its diplomatic mission to Somalia, marking the latest step towards restoring diplomatic ties since the U.S. withdrawal from the war-torn nation in early 1990s. However, the U.S. State Department said Tuesday that a new U.S. mission will be located not in Somalia, but in the U.S. embassy in neighboring Kenya. Ambassador Awad said his arrival marks a new chapter for Somalia-U.S. relations.
Today was a great day for me and for the Somali people, the Somali government that I represent, by presenting my credentials to the American president, Barack Obama. The president has received me warmly. I have presented my credentials to him, giving him the greetings from our president, our prime minister, and our minister of foreign affairs and the Somali people. And he likewise expressed his happiness to have Somalia represented in Washington by an ambassador. Yes, indeed, challenges are always present to any embassy, any human being, and any entity. In the case of the Somali embassy in Washington, even more so. So you can imagine the effort that requires and the challenges that present. But I think there are challenges that could be overcome.
What does this mean to the overall relationship between Somalia and the United States?
This will mean a lot. It means a lot. America is the number one country in the world in terms of you know, economy and everything else in terms of influence. And to have a relationship with such an important country is vital for Somalia. And the embassy will work very hard to, as I said moments ago, to strengthen the relationship between Somalia and the United States, and to further cooperation between Somalia and the United States, and to bring the two peoples of Somalia and United States closer.
Acme Issa Awad is Somalia's new ambassador to the United States and the second in more than 24 years. He was speaking with Mohamed Olat Hassan of VOA's Somali service. U.S. officials, accompanied by representatives from more than 100 U.S. companies, have embarked on a high-level trade mission to Africa. The delegation is visiting the continent's 8 leading economies, including South Africa. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The delegation includes 154 representatives from 108 American companies. They are in Africa as part of the Trade Wins Initiative, aimed at exposing U.S. companies to investment opportunities in sub-Saharan Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama has made boosting trade ties with the continent a priority. The mission includes stops in Angola, Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Mozambique, Nigeria, Tanzania, and South Africa. With Chinese companies already dominating in many African countries, one trade expert says it will take more than a single trip for U.S. companies to clinch lucrative investment deals. Theo Josias heads business development at Sizwe Nzaluba Kobodo, a South African-based investment advisory firm. He says American companies must identify sectors most in need of investment, like energy and infrastructure.
Africa's dire financial constraints at the moment presents a massive opportunity for investors. Governments are giving away a lot in terms of incentives, a lot in terms of just wanting to make sure that they're bringing people into the territory.
Josiah says U.S. companies can capitalize on the weaknesses of their foreign competitors already rooted in Africa. Marcus Jadot, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Industry and Analysis, is leading the trade mission.
Our interest in Africa is long-term. Our companies lead the way in technology. We're focused on local workforce development, supporting the development of infrastructure, and investing in the communities in which we do business.
American companies are already visible in many African countries. There are close to 600 of them in South Africa, employing hundreds of thousands of locals. Jadot says bold measures are being taken to boost that number. The U.S. Commerce Department has doubled its presence in Africa and will soon be opening an office in Ivory Coast. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Americans, including President Barack Obama, reacted with an outpouring of sympathy for a 14-year-old boy who was arrested at a Texas high school after a teacher mistook his scientific project, a homemade clock, for a bomb. As Zlatika Hook reports, the incident has drawn attention to the blurry lines between caution and paranoia in the age of mass killings at U.S. schools and other public places.
14-year-old Ahmed Mohammed has a fascination with science and technology, especially wires and circuit boards. He has even won awards for some of his science projects. But the one he created recently got him into trouble. He built a digital clock out of a pencil case, and he brought it to school to show to his science teacher.
It's just like this one.
But another teacher at the MacArthur High School in Irving, Texas, got spooked by the wiry device, thinking it might be an explosive, and called the police. So instead of being praised, the teenage science whiz was handcuffed and taken to a police station.
They arrested me, and they told me that I committed a crime of a hoax bomb, a fake bomb.
The ninth grader is of Sudanese descent and Muslim. His parents and other members of the local Muslim community say he was singled out because of his race and religion.
I think this wouldn't even be a question if his name wasn't Ahmed Mohammed.
But local school authorities say that in the wake of mass killings at schools across the country, they have to take every potential threat seriously.
I want all of our families and the community and the entire nation to know that our student safety is our utmost priority in Irving.
Ahmed's science project gone awry has sparked nationwide sympathy for the boy. President Obama invited him to join other young scientists at the White House science event next month.
We at the White House and the president himself recognized there could be an opportunity to try to reach out to this young man and give him a unique opportunity to nurture that intellectual curiosity. And I think he's going to fit in quite well with the other young people who'll be at the White House on astronomy night.
President Obama has been encouraging students to engage in scientific invention and has hosted similar events for school children before. Zlatica Hoch, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Supposing here is Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on the All Africa Games in Brazzaville, Republic of Congo. Eritrean world record holder Zerzene Tadesa won men's half marathon on the last day of the athletics competition on Thursday. Ethiopian Mamitu Daska triumphed in the women's race. On the track, Aureole Dongmo won women's shot put in a Cameroon national record of 17.21 meters. Ivory Coast's Kofi Wilfred Hua and Marie-Jose Talou won men's and women's 200 meters respectively. Egypt's Ihab Abdelrahman El Sayed and Botswana's Kabelo Hosimang triumphed in men's javelin and high jump respectively. Ethiopians Getane Mola and Dawit Seyaum prevailed in men's 5,000 meters and women's 1,500 meters respectively. Nigeria bagged gold medals through men's long jumper Samson Idiata, Amaka Ogoegbonam in women's 400 meter hurdles and the women's 4x400 meter relay. Kenya set a men's 4x400 meter relay championship record of 3 minutes and 0.34 seconds. The old mark of 3 minutes and 0.55 seconds was run by Nigeria in Nairobi, Kenya in 1987. Still with athletics, at the end of the 5 days of athletics, Nigeria topped the medal table with 10 gold, 9 silver and 4 bronze medals. Ethiopia is a distant second with 6 gold medals, 5 silver and 6 bronze medals. Kenya is third with 5 gold, 9 silver and 6 bronze medals. In all, 25 out of 54 African countries appeared on the athletics medal table. Turning to football, in the men's game, Nigeria pipped Republic of Congo 5-3 in a post-match penalty shootout to clinch the bronze medal after a 0-0 deadlock in open play. While in the women's contest, Ivory Coast pipped Nigeria 2-1 to place third. Today, Friday, Burkina Faso plays Senegal in men's final, while in a repeat of events 4 years ago, Ghana and Cameroon clash in the women's final. In basketball, Nigeria edged Angola 61-59 as Mali outplayed Senegal 70-62 in women's semifinals. Cameroon pipped Mozambique 70-69 to place fifth as Ivory Coast outwitted Gabon 56-40 to claim seventh place. Finally, in handball, Angola dismissed Libya 30-18 in men's quarterfinals on Thursday. Nigeria beat Senegal 29-18. Egypt outwitted Ivory Coast 27-17 and Republic of Congo pipped Gabon 25-24. And that's it for Daybreak Africa sports news. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We'll see you on Monday morning. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The head of Burkina Faso's new ruling council says the president and the prime minister are safe in military custody and will soon be released. That is it for this Friday, September 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman. I'm James Butt in Washington saying, have a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk, what is blind date? Does it lead to an everlasting relationship? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing blind dates. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next on Straight Talk Africa, President Obama welcomes Pope Francis to Washington, D.C. His Holiness' visit to the U.S. comes ahead of his trip to Africa in November. We'll discuss the significance of the Pope's travel next Wednesday at 18:30.